Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with music critic Robert Christgau about Pete Townshend's new memoir.
He tap dances around this question for the entire book. And towards the very end, there's a quote in the piece, I don't remember the exact wording, in which he says, yeah, right, The Who is the best work I ever did.
Biographer and historian Amanda Foreman assesses J.K. Rowling's first novel for grown-ups, The Casual Vacancy.
Her anger is unmediated, and that lowers, it diminishes the tone and the effect of what she wants to achieve.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Well, in the era when some of the great rock icons of the 1960s have been producing memoirs, there's a new one by one of the most important of all, Pete Townshend. It's called Who I Am, a memoir. It's reviewed for us by the Dean of Rock and Roll Critics, Robert Christgau, who's here to talk about it. And welcome, Bob.
Good to see you.
All right. So at the beginning, you say provocatively, but I think many will agree, that if there's anybody, with the exception of Bob Dylan, who's got a business, writing a memoir, it's Pete Townshend. Why?
Because this was a man who always had a real affinity for the written word. He wrote a column for Melody Maker. Or was it NME? I've forgotten now. It's in the review. I've forgotten which one. He opened a bookstore. He started his own publishing house. And then, shortly after The Who broke up, he actually went to work as an editor for Faber. And he really was an editor at Faber.
And Faber is
a good house.
One of the most distinguished. T.S. Eliot was its director. Mm. And so Townshend went there as someone, as you say, who really is a kind of literary man. As a songwriter, do we see or hear that too?
He's a fine lyricist, especially in the early days. I'm not so sure he gets better. And at a certain point, as I expect we'll discuss, I have no real way of knowing whether he gets better because his music, for me, becomes very difficult to listen to, and in that I'm in a very large company.
Well, let's go back, Bob, to the early, really exciting days of The Who. What were they doing? We think of these three colossal bands, the Beatles, the Stones, and The Who. Were The Who just a slightly different generation that had that great song, My Generation? Were they doing something different?
Well, yes. They come up a year and a half after the Stones get together, 2 years, and much longer than the Beatles, because the Beatles, you know, go back all the way to 57. And their hits are a little later. They impact really in 65. But when he wrote My Generation, I don't think that he was speaking for his generation as opposed to the Rolling Stones or the Beatles generation, because as he makes very clear in this book, he sees them all as war babies, and that's a very important thing to him. And that's really what he's talking about.
So we mean babies born during World War II. And what was the—
Or shortly after.
Shortly thereafter. And what's the world they grew up in? What
Well,
for,
in Great Britain, it's different than the United States, because Great Britain is completely devastated by the Nazis. There are holes everywhere. And also no material goods at all for the first 6 or so years of his life.
And where did he grow up?
He grew up in London. His father was a professional musician, a swing musician, who also, when that didn't pan out for him, which he never gave it up entirely, but he also ran a junk shop. You know, a junk shop slash collectible shop is what it really seems to have been. It seems to have been a bit of most. It seemed to have a certain antique store quality, but also that he sold used goods cheap, you know.
And how was Townshend educated?
He's a very, very intelligent guy. As I say in the review, don't mistake these guys. All the great rock musicians, almost all of the great rock musicians of the 60s were pretty smart. But I would say that Townshend's mind is comparable to Lennon's or Dylan's, who are people who you think, gee, not only a genius creatively, but what a quick mind, you say. How quick. How many associations? He's like that. But he never got good grades. He went to art school, which, you know, we think of it, oh, that means he wanted to be an artist. No, that was what you did if you couldn't get into university and didn't want to stop educating yourself. A lot of British rockers end up in art school just because there was that track that existed in Great Britain but didn't exist here. And so he followed the track. Now, that he could draw. He was a cartoonist. And he was very interested in the conceptual part of art. So that, in particular, Peter Blake and the English pop artists of the 50s who preceded the American pop artists of the 60s. And in my view of it, his understanding of that conception of pop culture was really what distinguished him and what distinguished The Who from The Stones and The Beatles. Certainly when I first heard about him at a party in 66 at Clay Felker's house, I believe it was Jacques Levy, who later became the photographer for somebody in D.C. And I think that's the right name. Anyway, me and my girlfriend were talking to him, and he started telling us about this group called The Who. And he had two 45s, which he said he would loan us. We still have them. We never gave them back. They were Anyhow, Anywhere, Anyway, and Substitute, two British 45s.
Okay, now what did it sound like for you, someone who's steeped in all of this, when you hear that music for the first time, what are you hearing that's different?
What you heard was conceptualization of those two songs, that there was a different level of distance. Anyhow, Anywhere, Anyway, it wasn't even on the first album. People in the States didn't know about it. On the one hand, it's a declaration of freedom, but that freedom is represented, and this is quite explicit, and you know, if you have any brain at all, that they know they're doing this by some of the most chaotic music put on a 45 up till that time. Wonderful music, but by the standards of pop, very chaotic. So on the one hand, he's declaring freedom, and on the other hand, he is implicitly suggesting that freedom comes with it destruction and dissolution. He understands that tension. It's all there in a three-minute song. For me and Ellen Willis, the New Yorker critic, who was my girlfriend at that time, we were incredibly excited about this. And then there was You're a Substitute for Another Guy. There it was the lyric, I look pretty tall, but my heels are high. That was a level of lyric that in a pop song, yeah, Dylan, that was different. But in a pop song, we didn't even expect that yet from the Beatles. There was, or certainly was on it equaled the finest of the Beatles songs. Just in terms of how much disruptive, subversive, those are both cliches, and I would like to weaken them, but you know what I mean, thinking could be crammed into what appeared to be a pop trifle designed to deliquesce on the radio in 8 weeks.
And musically, what were they doing?
In the first song, it was about his guitar. In the second, there was more sheer pop graft. It was a very good melody.
And so they became this explosive force. Here they are, one of the greatest of all the bands. Townsend then also was hugely ambitious. I mean, our listeners, I'm guessing, will be most familiar with Tommy.
Right.
The rock opera, which wasn't really an opera. How does he handle all of this? Is this a narrative book the way Keith Richards' terrific memoir is, or are we looking at a different kind of book here?
Oh, no, it's handled chronologically. I haven't read the Richards book, to be honest with you, and so I can't compare the two. This format is pretty standard.
And is it his voice? You can tell it's his voice.
No, this is a guy who, when he was at Faber, they asked him to write a book of short stories, and he wrote a book of short stories that was published. I can't say I've ever read this either, but he was good enough to do it. And the very, very beginning of the book, the first chapter, it begins in medias res, right? It doesn't go back. He does what, you know, it's a smart conventional thing to do, the first time he ever smashed a guitar.
Hmm.
And it's very well handled. It's only about three pages, and it has real, not quite flair, but it has a lot of concrete detail. It's skillful. It brings you in. I said to my wife, oh, this one is going to be good, but it isn't.
Right. And I want to get at. What happens?
Well, for one thing, the fact that it's three pages long, this book is 507 pages, something like that. It's divided into, by my count, I counted 388. Your copy editor got 394. We made it over 380 sections. That's a lot of sections. in a 500-page book. It's very, very jumpy. It hops around. And I'm in favor of dividing long chapters. That's a perfectly legitimate, but not, it's too jumpy. And there's not a lot of concreteness, not a lot of storytelling. He tends to deal with everything with a lot of brevity and give you very few vignettes. Not none, but not a lot. And they're not especially deft either.
What about portraits? Any of those?
What I say in the review is that the portraiture occurs by accrual. You get a sense of what the major figures in his life are like, his wife, the other band members especially, Terrence Stamp, one of his two first managers, and a few other people. But is there that moment where there's two pages in which the person is deftly portrayed, as there is, for instance, in Chronicles all over the place sometimes?
Bob really Dylan's
just,
memoir.
Yeah, in just three or four sentences, he paints a portrait of a person as an artist. I mean, some of the best music criticism published in this millennium are in Chronicles about Harry Belafonte, about Ricky Nelson. There's nothing like that in this book. Nothing.
And so also
about his own work, that's not always true. But about other people's work, very, very little.
And what about the post-Who era? What about his solo career?
The problem with all of these memoirs, I guess probably not for Richard, since he never stopped doing what he started out doing. One reason they're writing a memoir is that they have the time, because people aren't that interested in their music anymore, even if they're making music. And I don't think he's quite as productive as he used to be. He made a lot of music as well as reuniting with The Who periodically, as he describes it quite credibly, against his better judgment, but because they really wanted to do it. I believe all of that stuff. I think he was charitable to these people, and I think he really would have preferred not to, although he also knew he was going to be picking up a paycheck, and he says that.
Bob, charitable to which people?
To Entwistle, who ran out of money. To Daltrey, he didn't know what the hell he was doing. Daltrey comes out very well in this book, by accrual, but Townsend's respect for Daltrey is quite palpable, and since I've never given a lot of thought to his metal as a man, let's say, I came away positively impressed by Roger Daltrey, a man not a tremendously intelligent guy, but a guy with real talent who has given an opportunity and developed his talent and worked on it and has had a good, fruitful life. He really does. I would say Daltrey really comes off very well, as does his poor first wife, Karen, who he's marries. He remains married to her for 30 years. One of the things I liked about this book for a while, in that Black and page 100 to 200, he's on the road. They're smashing up hotel rooms and drinking bottles of cognac by the bottle and screwing anybody they can find. And Townsend is trying to remain faithful to his wife and trying not to become a hopeless alcoholic, which he does for a while. But it really and that was when I was most with him. I sort of didn't care at that time I was having the narrative. The struggle really engaged me because I'm a great believer in marriage and monogamy myself, and how any touring musician deals with that problem, I know very well is a very nearly impossible issue. The struggle is very credible, and I like that.
And is Townsend a complex and tormented, self-contradictory guy, or is he just someone with enormous talent?
No. He's very contradictory. To be honest with you, I think the person with enormous talent who's not contradictory, I think those people are pretty rare. There are hints of child abuse and aren't ever fully fleshed out. His parents, his mother was she left his father for like 6 years, and he got to know her boyfriend, and then they went back. His mother was very flamboyant, and I'm sure difficult in some respects, and positive because he says so. So at a certain point, he's carted off to his grandmother, who does not seem to be much of a prize, and brought up by her when he's four or five, and this is hard for him. And there's no reason not to feel full sympathy. On the other hand, he doesn't make broad, radical claims about how wrecked he was and how he had to battle back. And that's heartening, too. He wasn't unloved, for, as I say in so many words. He was in many ways, a good family. His father was a remarkable man.
Remarkable how?
He stuck at being a musician for 20, 25 years. That's not an easy thing to do. And as Townsend describes him, once again, quite credibly, he worked hard, he took it seriously, He did what he had to do because he really cared about music and came out on top because he was both a pretty good musician and a together person.
And how much of The Who really holds up? If we have listeners
Everything
now.
Everything through Quadrophenia holds up. Mm. You know, I'm glad I get to publish in your journal and get my check. But in addition to that, what I got from this was less reading the book than having a reason to carve time out of my precious ear time and listen to all of those records. Many of them I listened to more than once. It was really fun. It was great. And I try to play the Townsend solo stuff. I happen to have, I don't have much of it, but I have a 2-CD compilation. I'm sorry. This is not an uncommon thing. And he says it, he admits it himself. He tap dances around this question for the entire book. And towards the very end, there's a quote in the piece, I don't remember the exact wording in which he says, yeah, right, The Who is the best work I ever did.
Thanks so much, Bob. That's Robert Christgau, who reviews Who I Am, a memoir by Pete Townsend, in this week's book review. J.K. Rowling's first novel for grown-ups is not only long-awaited, but breathlessly awaited, and it's called The Casual Vacancy. It's already a bestseller. It's reviewed for us by another best-selling author and a prize winner, Amanda Foreman, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi.
Okay, so first of all, you're a Rowling fan. We should get this straight, right? You admire the Harry Potter novels?
Yes. Hands down on the table, I've always been a huge fan, so much so that when I got married in 2000, my husband and I each took our own copy the latest Harry Potter novel that had come out at that time.
And you have children. You have, what, I think 5 children.
That's right.
And are they old enough yet to enter the world of Harry Potter or not quite?
I have children between the age of 5 and 10. So in my opinion, only the eldest 3. And actually, well, the youngest 2 can't read yet. So the 3 that can read are in the world of Harry Potter. But we've staggered it. You know, because the Harry Potter books become more complicated, the themes become much darker, they touch on much older, much mature aspects of growing up as the novels progress. And, you know, I don't want an 8-year-old reading a book that's really aimed for 16-year-olds.
So that leads us to The Casual Vacancy, which is not written for children. What, briefly, is Rowling doing in this novel, Amanda?
I would say The Casual Vacancy is aimed at 16-year-olds and above. So anybody with a developed moral sensibility could and should read this book. Yes, there's some salty language in there, but it's in no way beyond the appreciation or, I think, ability to put it into perspective of a mature teenager. This is a classic Victorian-style social novel. These are the novels of Thomas Hardy, George Eliot, Charles Dickens, who wrote their novels in order to bring aspects of social injustice and social deprivation to the wider reading population of the Victorian world.
Now, before we get to the specific issues, why don't you just kind of set the scene for us? This is a kind of provincial or rural novel Rowling has written. Where's it set?
The Casual Vacancy is set in a supposedly idyllic town in an idyllic part of the British countryside. She has called this town Pagford, which is a conglomeration of Pangbourne, Bagford, all sorts of famous British names that British readers will recognize.
And she's very good at spinning tales and plots and creating vivid characters. Has Rowling done that in this novel too?
I would agree with you that one of Rowling's really incredible talents is an ability to draw human beings and to come out with these very sharp observations of human mannerisms and failings that make her characters come alive. And that is certainly true for The Casual Vacancy, that she spins a tale with many characters, all of whom they are clearly real to her, and therefore, to some extent, they are real to us.
Is it a family story or generational story?
The Casual Vacancy is a multi-household story. In fact, I mean, it's sprawling. There's at least 8 households, husbands, wives, children's. I mean, she could have very easily had a cast of characters at the beginning of the book. And actually, at the beginning, for the reader, it's quite difficult keeping track on the various sons and daughters and wives and nieces and nephews and hangers-on that do populate this novel.
So she really is writing in the tradition of an Eliot or a Dickens or a Hardy, as you say. What are the social issues that are most, that are paramount to her?
I think that J.K. Rowling has a very interesting moral sensibility, that she is concerned about people who are voiceless, that have their life experiences translated and explained by others who have a voice because they are educated, because they have money, because they have a position in society. And she feels that the voiceless, the very, very poor, those with drug problems, children of the very poor, those who come from deprived backgrounds, therefore have their behaviors and their experiences not simply described on their behalf, but mistranslated, mistold, so that the reality of their suffering is lessened, in fact, even swept under the carpet, and while their behavior, often antisocial, is exaggerated and turned into a tool to be used against them. So she sees herself as an advocate for the dispossessed.
Is she angry? Is she angry about England? Is she angry about the state of modern life and the 21st century?
In my opinion, I think that J.K. Rowling is very angry. She feels that the people that she wants to protect, the victims, have been, as it were, shouting and no one has been listening. She wants to be their advocate. And these are, I think, extremely laudable aims. This is a person in J.K. Rowling who is not frivolous, who has clearly thought about the issues, who feels very passionate about social injustice. So one might ask, therefore, what is there to criticize about such a laudable book that has such clear aims? Shouldn't we all be celebrating it?
And the answer?
Well, unfortunately, you know, literature isn't simply agitprop. You know, novels as moral messages are something that, you know, the Victorians perfected, but that we live in the 21st century, and adult readers, while are happy to have a moral message in their book, it can't simply be the crowning achievement of a novel. We also expect our novels to be literary if they have pretensions to be a literary novel. And in this book, The Casual Vacancy, it has pretensions to be a literary novel, and therefore it has to be judged along those lines. This isn't a primer for teenagers. This isn't a book written for the socially uneducated. This is a book written for people who already have a keen moral sensibility, clearly. And therefore, the first question is, do these people need to be educated in quite the ham-fisted way that J.K. Rowling believes they need to be?
And Amanda, how does that ham-fistedness show? Are there virtuous characters posed against exaggeratedly evil ones? Is the prose overheated? Are the scenes and developments of character missing the kind of subtlety and nuance we look for? What is the missing ingredient, or the several missing ingredients here?
Well, I think that you have named several of them. What is missing in this novel? Well, I think the first and most important aspect that's missing in this novel is an adult sensibility. Mm. Children respond to quite simplistic narrative and literary devices. They like to have moral arguments which will be master's dialogue, so that you have person A and person B. Each will have a moral exposition. It will come across as dialogue, but simply a moral point is being made. They like their characters to reflect the inner badness or goodness within, so that they are easily identifiable. That works for children. None of these things work for adults. Life just isn't that simplistic. Now, I suspect J.K. Rowling would counter and say, oh, but I haven't made any of my characters that likable. The problem is that she has actually made most of them into labels: the wife-beater, the gossip, the fantasist, the wastrel, and so on. So there's a fine line between likability and simply being the straw man with which to hang on certain objectionable traits. Unfortunately, she crossed that line.
For a serious writer and critic and intellectual like yourself, is it possible, having read The Casual Vacancy, to detach it from the Harry Potter books, or do you now go back and look at those books a little differently? Is there something that comes through here that illuminates in some way, or even undermines at all what she's done before? Or is she working in so different an area now that this novel can be just read entirely separately from the previous ones?
I think The Casual Vacancy should be read entirely differently. If one wanted to, 30 years from now, when there are university courses studying J.K. Rowling, one might want to look for the similarities and dissimilarities in style and in message. There's a great similarity in style, actually, between the books, and there's a great similarity in message. One of the most important messages in the Harry Potter novels is the importance for everyone, and also children, not to settle for conventional thinking, to reject the popular moral messages for often the unpopular moral messages. And I believe that in the penultimate novel, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, that Rowling actually transcended the genre. That is a book, in particular, whose moral message is very clear and very subtle. That book says that duty and sacrifice will not bring their own rewards, that in chaotic times and times of war, each of us may be called upon to make some kind of act for which there will be no recognition beyond one's own recognition that oneself has done right. And that is a very mature message for children to have to take on. So she's clearly capable of seeing the larger, more elevated scope of moral life. The problem with The Casual Vacancy is that some of her larger moral messages are lost within a sea of sentimentality. Mm. And it's very apparent in the writing. It's very apparent in the end, which I think is mawkish and overblown. Her anger is unmediated, and that lowers, it diminishes the tone and the effect of what she wants to achieve.
Thanks so much, Amanda. That's Amanda Foreman, who reviews J.K. Rowling's new novel for grown-ups, The Casual Vacancy, in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg, what's new on the lists this week?
On the fiction side of things, there's a whole lot of change. I'll run down them from the bottom up. At number 14, Patrick Taylor is new on the list with An Irish Country Wedding. Just above him at 13, Iris Johansson has a new Eve Duncan mystery called Sleep No More. At number 11, there's a second novel based on the Walking Dead TV series about zombies. This book is called The Road to Woodbury. It's by Robert Kirkman and Jay Banansinga. At number 8, Kate Morton, an Australian novelist, has a new novel out called The Secret Keeper. At number 4, Patricia Cornwell's 20th Kay Scarpetta book, The Bone Bed, is new on the list. At number 2, Justin Cronin, who had a big hit with his vampire novel, The Passage, is new on the list with its sequel called The 12. And at number 1, Mensa member Nelson DeMille is new on the list with The Panther.
He's a Mensa member?
He is. He says so on his website. He's also a Vietnam vet, and this book is the latest in his John Corey series about a former cop turned anti-terrorism expert.
And what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, at number 15, Chrystia Freeland, the journalist, she's an editor at Thomson Reuters, is new on the list with a book called Plutocrats. She went out and interviewed a lot of kind of the super rich, the economic elite, the not just the 1%, but the 0.1%, to get their take on things and to look at the increasing income disparities.
Wasn't that excerpted recently in The New Yorker?
I assume that was an excerpt, yes. She talked about people who are feeling sort of snake-bitten by President Obama, people who supported him the first time around and now resent what they see as the class warfare he's been engaging in. And The New Yorker ran that as an article, right?
And anything else?
Yeah. At number 7, Mark Bowden, who's famous, of course, for Black Hawk Down, has a new book called The Finish, which takes us from 9/11 right up to the killing of Osama bin Laden.
And he goes pretty deeply inside what, military strategy or SEALs, or is it kind of a blow-by-blow account? It's
not just about the bin Laden killing. It's really about counterterrorism strategy and how America responded to 9/11 and how we finally were able to get bin Laden. So yes, he goes into kind of the nitty-gritty. Yeah. And then at number six, a book I know you're excited about as a big Duran Duran fan, their bassist John Taylor has written an autobiography called In the Pleasure Groove.
And I have to say, Greg, having read your column, I had never heard of John Taylor and had no idea that he's such a heartthrob among women of a certain age.
Well, his rise coincided with the rise of MTV. And so Duran Duran, their big hit was Rio. They had Hungry Like the Wolf. There was a string of years there in the early to mid 80s when you could not turn on MTV without seeing a Duran Duran video. And this coincided with the time that I was in junior high school, and I'm telling you, there was not a girl's locker in my middle school that did not have a picture of John Taylor up. He was kind of the Justin Bieber of his day.
And what does he do now? He's still in the band?
They have reunited. They have a new number one record out. It's not number one now, but it hit number one. And he writes in the book about the struggles he had with dealing with fame. He was addicted to cocaine for quite a time during the band's biggest success. He slept with a lot of groupies. He has a part in the book where he says that they used to put on their U.S. tour schedule, there were numbers written on the top of each page for the states they were going through that were code for the age of consent in each of those states.
Well, there's an uplifting memoir.
Yeah. He's now married to the co-founder of Juicy Couture.
And do we know how old she is?
No.
But old enough to know better, we assume. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.